This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, we're going to bring back our conversation with State Representative Charlie Brown of Gary, who is now headed into Indianapolis next week for his final term in office at the General Assembly. We'll bring you our conversation. Also, too, we'll find out a little bit more about Hannah's Hope, how it got started, and how it's benefiting Northwest Indiana. And then we'll have a Lakeshore-focused conversation from Lakeshore PBS with host Keith Kirkpatrick and his guest, Congressman Pete Visklosky. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. This is Indiana State Representative Charlie Brown's final term of office at making attendance to Indianapolis for the General Assembly session. And we've had a chance recently to speak with Representative Charlie Brown about his last trek to Indy for the General Assembly session, the time he spent there, and what he's hoping to do after he decides to finish up his term of office as a state representative.
It is a challenge, especially having to travel in the dead of winter, you know, by virtue of us having to be there during the long session from January through the end of April. And next year, we have to wrap up. We start on January 3rd, and we have to wrap up by March 15th during the short session. I've worn out quite a few vehicles over the 35-year period that I have been taking this sojourn to Indianapolis. And it is a real challenge that many folk do not realize what a challenge it is, family-wise, health-wise, and just a toll on that long ride, especially around the Rensselaer, Lafayette area.
Oh, yeah.
With always some kind of snow issue that is different from the area up here in Northwest Indiana. So, and then looking at the Democratic numbers in the House of Representatives, I feel it's safe to say that it will be a while before we can look at being in the majority again. And I said, it's time to let someone else pick up that mantle and take that trip and learn more about state government and how we function down there.
Now, over the years, you have championed a number of causes, and in particular for us in Northwest Indiana here, you've been one of the chief supporters of anything involving Northwest Indiana, not only in politics, but business and economic development and the like, to your colleagues downstate. Much as I hate to use that word, the folks in Illinois don't care, but I do not like to use the word downstate because it kind of denotes that there are two states, and right now there's only one in Indiana. But the idea is that you have basically an opportunity, and you've used this opportunity over the years as I guess a bully pulpit, no doubt, but an opportunity to really, really promote Northwest Indiana to your colleagues at the State House, as well as other people, I'm sure, in Central Indiana that could care less about Northwest Indiana.
Absolutely. It is kind of intriguing that those from the southern end of the state, when they walk into the chamber, they start out with a negative sense or feel for what is known as the region.
Right.
And it's mostly negative. You know, they obviously they may have heard some positive things, but the things that stick with them is the number of elected officials that have been indicted and maybe gone to jail, and this whole issue of the dead voting, that there are a lot of more votes than there are citizens in the region. And that's what they talk about, and they don't realize how painful that is, that they walk in, never been to this area of the state, but yet are talking negatively about this area of the state. And that's why I made a couple of efforts in trying to get, years and years ago, we used to have, during the summer months, there would be hosts in a given region to invite all 150 50 legislators into the region, and it's social, but it's also an opportunity to get other legislators who are not familiar with a given area to learn more about that, and also it helps the local legislators who may be hosting that to get their colleagues to see the needs of that particular area. And so we used to rotate that people would come. We would have a weekend activity here in Lake County, and then we would travel to the southern end of the state, Evansville or farther south, and try to get camaraderie and understanding of the needs of that community by the entire body.
I recall talking with you in one of our earlier regionally speaking programs, and I'm talking like around 2010, about some of these first trips where you've invited state lawmakers from elsewhere in the state to come to Northwest Indiana, and there's always very positive results. You get some great comments, and I guess you hate to think it sounds so trite, but some of them, I'm sure, say, I never knew this happened. I never knew it was like this.
But absolutely. That's the exact reaction to when they come up here and see the beauty of the lakefront or the ambiance of this area, and that it is not all what they read in the newspaper about this area. And, you know, I used to get upset with the reference to the region, but the Affordable Care Act became known as Obamacare. Well, you turn that around and you make it into a positive, and that's what we have attempted to do in terms of using the terminology, the region.
I know one of the big things that you're most associated with and very proud of as far as economic development is concerned is working with the fellow lawmakers and establishing the bill that became law back in 2005 that established the Northwest Indiana Regional Development Authority. And although the RDA has its detractors, even today, there are still a lot of people who are very supportive of the efforts that were made to help find a way for Northwest Indiana to be officially recognized as a spot where economic development not only needs to be, but is welcome, to be sure. So I'm sure that makes you feel good knowing that is one of the accomplishments that you've been able to see over the decades as a state lawmaker.
And former legislator Representative Chet Dobus is to be commended for coming up with the concept of a regional development authority, mm-hmm. mainly from the standpoint of we work in silos, as opposed to broadening and not looking just at the corporate limits of the city of Gary or the city of Hobart, but to look at, even if you do something that is specific to Gary, it benefits the entire area. If you do something in Hobart, it benefits all of us throughout the Lake County area. So this concept of a regional development authority has helped us come closer together and getting everyone to put resources and revenue into a pool to do specific and complete specific projects in a given area.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with State Representative Charlie Brown, the Democrat from Gary. He's decided he's not going to run for re-election after this General Assembly session. That will be his last. And look to the future, here in Northwest Indiana in particular. And Representative Brown, I know besides economic development and your pushes to make sure that Northwest Indiana gets its fair share of state funds to come up here to deal with economic development, making life better for everybody up here, I know you've worked very hard to make personal lives better through your healthcare efforts, not only as being an educator in the past, but also working with healthcare issues. And one of the things I know you're best known for, and I'm sure you're most proud of, is the bill back in 2007 that helped create what is now Healthy Indiana Plan and what's happened from that. And I know that you used a personal example, I think, in one of the information I read that you used a private-public partnership to help show how important that having this program really, really is.
Yes, and many still do not realize that, you know, there's no sense in my saying I'm upset because I don't have a job, I'm upset because I'm not able to participate in certain activities, but your health is the most important thing to you. And the number of people that were going without any means of health care, and not realizing, I finally was able to convince my colleagues that it's like that old Fram oil commercial that was around years and years ago, where somebody didn't want to take care of their car by putting oil in it, and the commercial simply said, you pay me now or you pay me later. Ma'am. And that's what was happening as it relates to health care, that if we did not get to the point of saying, looking at those persons that did not have or could not afford health care, that ultimately their bodies are going to break down, and it then shifts that responsibility to the state or to the federal government. So why not provide some preventive efforts and maintenance efforts for these folks so that we would not have a big bill at the end because they did not or were not able to have basic preventive and care.
One of the efforts that, of course, we mentioned here about the Healthy Indiana Plan that is the result of the bill that became law that you you authored in the General Assembly back in the last decade has come to fruition, and some great benefits that have come out of that to help people in Indiana that otherwise couldn't afford health care. I know that you've also worked very hard, too, over the decades to see that there would be a statewide smoking ban put in place. And I know one, it was tough, I know, during 2012 to see the last opportunity for that bill to go through, and it made it, but it got amended so many times,
yeah,
with so many exemptions. I'm sure that was probably the roughest time, even of all the years that you'd put an effort in that never got out of committee, or much less even to be considered on the Indiana House floor, to see all those changes made. But in light of that today, how do you think things have shaped up as far as having at least a modified statewide smoking ban?
Yeah, and it is, I'm proud of the fact that we did take that initial step and at least make some efforts to free. That's the most pleasing thing to me, that a total stranger may walk up to me and introduce themselves and say, I appreciate your efforts. Now I can go to my favorite restaurant and not have to be bothered or consuming all of that secondhand smoke. And that will be I will introduce that bill again this year to say no exemptions. That I know the casinos have kind of cornered the market with, state, if you force us to go smoke free, you are going to lose revenue, as well as we, the individual casinos, are going to lose revenue. I don't necessarily buy into that, because you look at our next door neighbor to the west, Illinois, has casinos and they are totally smoke free. And I don't think the first year they may have dipped when they went to smoke-free, but that, I think, was basically because of the economy. Mm-hmm. So if we say, and they made an effort here in Gary through the city council to try to get through that there would be no smoking at the Gary casinos, but, and I understand and appreciate the fact that the opposition said that, we're going to lose because the people will then go to East Chicago or to Hammond or to Michigan City if we're going to go, if we're the only one that do not allow smoking. So it's going to have to be a statewide effort. And I think that the state chamber, surprisingly, is one of my strongest supporters in this endeavor to say that in private clubs, in bars, and in casinos, we should be smoke-free.
Well, we'll see how that does when you introduce that in the upcoming session. Is there anything else that you have on your mind or that you already plotted out and got the initial efforts worked on to introduce any measures in the 2018 General Assembly session, which is going to be your last?
This is the most important one. Yeah. We are limited to 5 bills during the short session. There are a couple of others that I'm working on for the city of Gary. But the main issue, and I'm going to appeal to all my colleagues, that let me walk out of the door with this achievement of Indiana, the entire state is smoke-free.
Okay. Let me ask you, Charlie Brown, you mentioned these great accomplishments that have already come to place, even if they've been amended. the smoking ban in particular for Indiana. What else do you think that you're going to be able to take home to tell people that your family already knows about for all the years that you've talked with them about the issues that you've had to deal with, and your colleagues up here in Northwest Indiana that are on the General Assembly? Anything in particular that you want to at least tell people that you're most proud of from all the decades, 35 years plus, that you've served as a state representative?
Well, years ago, we had to have a settlement with all of the tobacco companies because they were not being totally truthful about the ingredients in their cigarettes. And mm-hmm. so the federal government stepped in and said, all of you tobacco companies, the primary ones and even the secondary ones, you owe revenue back to the individual states based on the calculations we have made that the damage that has been done to individuals there. And some formula came up, but Indiana was due a little over $2 billion in the tobacco settlement issues. And that is one that I authored and sponsored in the House of Representatives that brought over $2 billion spread out over the years to Indiana as a result of the settlement with the tobacco company. And that revenue, Indiana was the first state, I don't know if we're still the only one, that dedicated the total amount to health care and preventive endeavors in the state of Indiana.
Yeah, a lot of efforts have been created here over the years for smoking cessation and prevention and all.
Absolutely.
And a lot of it, and it's all being supported by that money from the settlement, to be sure. How do you think that Northwest Indiana is going to fare now that from last year's General Assembly session, earlier this year is what I meant to say, about the way to help fund infrastructure improvements, and most notably roads and bridges with the increase in the fuel taxes?
Well, you can see some of the fruits of that already by virtue of the repaving of 51, which is Broadway, the whole length of it going from Gary, the beginning at the northern end of Gary and going straight through Maryville and out to Crown Point. And you can see it on I-65 where they're adding another lane south of Maryville where it comes down to two lanes, and there I'm not aware of whether they have begun the work on the bridges, but it is without a doubt one of the main projects that we needed here in Lake and Porter County,
right. Mm-hmm.
Dealing with the roads and so forth. Another effort that I hate to leave undone is the emissions test, where 92 counties in Indiana, only Lake and Porter counties have to have the automobiles go through this emissions test. And research has shown that the local cars are not above the allowable amount of emissions. We have the unfortunate situation of being lumped in with Chicago and the Chicagoland area, where the major portions of the emitting above the EPA limits have been occurring.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have worked and tried hard to get Lake and Porter County drawn out of that geographic map that they have.
Okay.
And we have even talked to our congressional delegation. But the efforts, it will have to be carried on by someone else, because it looks like it won't happen during the next session, whatever will ultimately come out of why we, the only Lake and Porter County, are the only two counties that have to have our cars taken every other year to have this testing done.
State Representative Charlie Brown, conversation with him here as he got ready this past fall for his final session in the General Assembly, as he closes out his career as a state legislator and decides to run for local office. We'll, of course, be keeping an eye on Charlie Brown as he makes his efforts in local politics there, too. There is an organization here in Northwest Indiana called Hannah's Hope, and we'll find out more about it from the family members who helped create the program. It's the idea of Michael and Mary Martinez here in Northwest Indiana, and Michael is with us to talk about Hannah and about Hannah's Hope. Thanks for being with us today.
Chris, thanks for having me.
Well, tell us a little bit about Hannah Martinez, the young lady who sadly is not with us any longer, but she seems to live on in the form of the nonprofit organization.
Correct. Hannah was, and it still is, my middle daughter. She was born with a prenatal stroke, is what we were eventually told the diagnosis was, and you know, with that suffered many challenges along the way developmentally. Mm-hmm. And what my wife and I did was shortly after finding out her diagnosis, we had an idea to host a golf outing. And what we did with that golf outing was to raise some money for other kids with special needs and got involved in the First Steps program, which helped Hannah with therapies and her development aspect of life. And we ended up having a golf outing 8 years ago, and we've spawned into this little organization here that is now Hannah's Hope, which we thought would be just a small little endeavor and just turned into this big thing. But Hannah was, she was an inspiration. I've told people 1,000 times, she never spoke a word, never took a step, and she did more with her 3 years on this earth than most people do in a lifetime.
One of the things that you know when you go to the website and take a look at the mission statement to learn more about Hannah's Hope is that it's an organization that provides developmental equipment to kids with special needs, as well as connecting families by making life and communities more accessible. And one of the things that's interesting, too, which kind of gets us to the latest event here, is the grand opening of what is called Hannah's Hope Playground. Tell us where it's located and describe it. I understand it's a very, very unique playground.
It is. It is the brainchild of 7 years of sitting, looking at magazines, trying to pick out unique equipment so that all kids can play regardless of ability. It again started as an idea while sitting at a park out in Schererville, where my wife and I were there with my oldest daughter at the time, and only one of the two children could play. There was no equipment for Hannah to use. Mm-hmm. And what we did is, we teamed up with Game Time, which is a playground equipment manufacturer, in Sinclair Recreation out of Michigan. And we've opened a playground right in downtown Portage at Founders Square, right behind the new fire station. It's a 17,000 square foot playground with some very unique equipment. It is going to be recognized as a national demonstration site for playground in terms of inclusivity. And what we did is, about a week and a half ago, we opened up that playground with a ribbon cutting, and we had probably 300 people there, parents and kids alike, which we're able to now reconnect families to play as one cohesive unit if you did have a child with special needs.
Now, you usually think of a playground having the typical slides and swings and things like that, and maybe a teeter-totter, you know, within the new version of that. What is so unique about what's been set up in this particular playground? Because I know that you've designed it on purpose to make sure that youngsters with developmental issues can learn as well as grow and hopefully get stronger.
Correct. We still have the slides. We still have swings. We still have the teeter-totters. We still have all those things that you would find at a normal playground. We did not want to have this playground known as, you know, quote-unquote, the handicapped playground. We wanted this to be a playground for all. But some of the equipment that we have a roller table. So if a child is in a wheelchair, they can put themselves on this table and kind of pull themselves through this little tunnel on these roller bars. The seesaw that we have is not your typical two-person seesaw. It is a seesaw made for four or five people. There are two seats on each side with a small disc in the middle where if a child is unable to sit up, they can lay down on the disc. We have six or seven different types of swings. And on many of the pieces of equipment that you go there, we have a small sticker that Hannah's Hope put up there with a QR code that a parent or a therapist can scan that QR code, and it takes to a website which gives ideas on how to utilize that equipment for developmental purposes.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. What kind of a reaction have you gotten since the grand opening to this very unique and all the features on this playground?
We've yet to hear a bad word about it. We've had nothing but great feedback. A lot of what Hannah's Hope has done in the past is, like you had mentioned earlier, Chris, was we purchased equipment for kids. Mm-hmm. So if you attended a Hannah's Hope event and, you know, you donated money to our golf outing or a bowling tournament or a craft fair or something of that nature, you know, that money was put to good use. We don't have any paid employees. We're all volunteers. And that money was to help a kid somewhere down the line, you know, reach their fullest potential. But, you know, our supporters don't always get to see that. So to have this playground be a very tangible item that everyone can wrap their head around and go grab with their hands and say, you know what, I went to a Hannah's Hope event, I was a part of this, and we tell everyone, this is your playground as much as it is ours.
Now, I know that you and your wife, Mary, have devoted so much time and energy into this project in particular, the playground in particular, but obviously everything else that is offered by the Hannah's Hope organization. Any other things that you all have in mind or are in the works right now that you're hoping to be able to unveil in the future?
Well, there's still going to be, you know, we had a lot of questions, you know, that exact question. What is the next project for Hannah's Hope?
Right.
We are going to continue on a daily basis to help kids throughout Northwest Indiana reach their fullest potential, either through equipment, utilizing the playground. We're going to continue those missions that we do. But also, there's also going to be a phase two to the playground. We're going to need some seating. We're going to need some more shade. There's also going to be an entryway sign that we're going to put up. So, you know, we've told people a thousand times that we've been talking about this playground for so long. This is not the end of Hannah's Hope. This is just the beginning. I really think this playground now being so tangible for Northwest Indiana is going to really be a jumpstarter for us.
Now, do you think that there are other projects that Hannah's Hope is going to be able to work with in conjunction with working with the city of Portage, in addition to the expansion that you want to see on the playground?
We've never ruled anything out. Anytime anyone would like to come with us with an idea, if it fits our mission and we can help, we're gonna do our best to do so. I can't say for certain, but I mean, who knows? There may be another playground in another city somewhere along the line.
Michael Martinez, thank you very much for spending time talking with us about Hannah and about Hannah's Hope. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Chris. It was my pleasure.
Michael Martinez, who along with his wife Mary have created Hannah's Hope. It's a nonprofit charity that was started in honor of Hannah Martinez, who passed away at the age of 3. She had been born with severe brain damage caused by a prenatal stroke, but her memory is living on in the hopes of helping other young people that have developmental problems and their families be able to cope with these things and learn and grow from them. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and it's time once again for a Lakeshore-focused conversation from Lakeshore PBS. Today, it's host Keith Kirkpatrick and his guest, Congressman Pete Fisklosky.
There is one face and one name known above all others in our region of Northwest Indiana. And that name and that face, including the rest of him, mind, body, and voice, are here with us in the studio. United States Congressman Peter Fisklosky, representing Indiana's 1st Congressional District. You've been at this quite a while now, right?
Keith, I have, and it's great to be on your program finally. It's been a while.
It has been. But you've been in Congress now 36 years?
33 years.
Yes,
sir.
Okay, I got to do a better math of this. So at what point, Pete, do you get to be called venerable? Is it enough gray hair than years you've been or your age?
Keith, I'm a public servant. I just try to keep my head down and work hard every day.
So have you been called that, though?
I have never been called that. I have been called a lot of names, though.
Well, I could use that one, but maybe you're not quite old enough for that one. Maybe you got to be a little older than this to get the venerable title.
Right.
But I'm glad to really have you on the show.
Thank you very much.
So we live in interesting times.
We do.
And you're in Washington in interesting times. So I think one of the greatest criticisms people have is, what's wrong with Congress that you people can't figure out how to work together? What's your take on this?
Keith, there's really two answers. One is we do have problems as far as the functioning of the day-to-day running of the United States government. Our year started on October 1st. We will not, under the best of circumstances, complete the funding decisions to run the government until December 8th. During the past fiscal year, we did not resolve our differences until the middle of May. We don't have enough time on your program to go through all of the reasons as to why this happens. But I would say there's a number of political parties in the Congress, and there is a group of individuals who, just as my colleague Charlie Dent, a Republican from Pennsylvania, said, couldn't bring themselves to say yes to the sun coming up tomorrow. And as you can imagine,
what is wrong with? I mean, I got to say,
Keith, I don't know what the motivation is, and unfortunately, in any process, legislative work. If you want to do nothing as you hit a deadline, your leverage increases. My great frustration on behalf of the people I represent is the vast majority of the members of the House and Senate are decent human beings. They are intelligent human beings. They do work hard. They want to leave the world a little bit better. But the extremes have really hijacked the process.
So how do those people get elected, those extremes? Are they really from a district that has that many extreme people who are voting for them?
Some of it is redistricting, has come very, very precise. Some of it, I would point out, when I first ran for Congress, understanding that was some years ago, in a 15-month campaign, I raised $80,000. And I beat an incumbent member of Congress. Today, money has awashed the system with these super PACs that are accountable to no one. I think also the fact that there is no real solid news in the video media nationally anymore. You turn on a cable news network program, and there's four people with one shred of information, with four opinions. And where is the news about what's happening in Indonesia today or the flood in Japan?
On National Public Radio and TV.
That's
where it's at.
That and BBC.
Mm-hmm. BBS and BBC.
If you want news, those are the two outlets to go to. I would suggest to you the majority of Americans are not accessing that news. So the lack of facts make this debate very difficult. I can't tell you how many times people have come up to me and say, I've seen this on the internet. I said, well, here are the facts. They said, you're lying to me. I said, if I was going to lie to you, I would make you happy. You're still unhappy. These are the facts. Well, I saw it on the internet, or I saw it on this program, or I heard it on this radio program. Also, the impulse of many public officials to have an opinion like that because something happened 3 minutes ago because of social media. So there's many contributing factors. There is no excuse. And I would say structurally, the big problem we face right now is an act called the Budget Control Act that was passed after the 2010 election that still is going to be in place, absent its repeal for another 4 years, that again has structured the fiscal debate in a very bizarre, artificial, unproductive fashion.
Yeah, this has been going on, this whole budget thing, for years
a whole
years
decade.
Now.
And I would tell you, again, I have great responsibilities for funding the Department of Defense. Secretary of Defense, who is a very solid human being, very competent human being. I have great respect for Secretary Mattis, Chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff. They're beside themselves. And I've told some of my colleagues who, because they want to cut spending, you have now wasted more money with continuing resolutions, with sequestration across the board cuts, with shutting down the government, with the uncertainty. You've wasted more time of people's lives planning three different budget scenarios. Let us at least run the day-to-day operation of the government.
But that opinion must not be the predominant opinion of trying to do this, because it doesn't happen, right?
Keith, I believe it is the majority opinion in the Congress, but the way the majority party has structured the debate on the floor, referencing back to two speakers ago, there's an internal custom that unless a majority of the majority party agrees to a bill, it will not hit the floor.
So we got a lot of rules that don't seem to make a whole lot of sense anymore. Well, let me ask you this. If this is like fighting a losing war, right? And the way you maybe can win, you say, if there's one thing we can do, we're just going to throw everything at one thing, and hopefully it'll break it loose or maybe start the change. If there was one thing that you could do, or we could do, what would that strategic thing be? or that risky thing?
It's not really a risky thing. It's just day-to-day operation of the government. And we have done it twice temporarily, and that is to essentially modify and set aside the Budget Control Act. But we have done it temporarily twice. We may have an opportunity again to do it this fall. If so, I would hope we do away with the Budget Control Act. Not because I do not want to balance the budget. We have done that within recent memory. But to remove these artificial constraints on what do we need today? We need to invest in this country. We need to bring equity and simplicity to the tax code. We are a nation at war. We have an aging population and have to preserve entitlement programs for the next generation. And these artificial rules are just destroying the ability to address those issues. There are people talking about trying to come to some agreement where, for example, there's something in it you don't like and I don't like. And there's something in it you like and I like. That is doing a deal. That is an agreement. That is compromise.
But you know,
and that has been absent.
You know what's interesting as you talk about this, because everybody talks how far we are apart in this country on polar opposites of things. But I think one thing is, I think most of us agree what the big issues are in this country. You just rattled them off. And I think all sides would say, yep, those are the big things. Fix the taxes. What are we doing with the elderly? We got issues. You know, just you kind of went through the whole litany of them, and I think that makes a lot of sense. Is that a starting point?
It's a starting point, and we have to convince public officials in Washington that the country, the people of this country, I believe, are ahead of them. When I have talked about these issues, including entitlement programs, Social Security, Medicare, that are earned benefits people have paid taxes on, at town forums, and I've said this very thing, and that we need to make changes to preserve it for the next generation, nobody has strung me up. Now, we can debate exactly what the best way to do it. What has happened, particularly with the entitlement programs, and I remind people, it's two-thirds of every dollar we spend. Social Security, Medicare, some Medicaid, a couple of farm programs, interest on the debt. And we've been fighting over everything else. No, that's the rub, is when George Bush said we're going to privatize Social Security, it was like, that's the third rail. So I would tell you very frankly, my party has loved beating up Republicans, because you're going to do away with these programs. Republicans, who are tired of getting beat up, they don't want to talk about it at all. The president has said, we're not going there. So let's just leave two-thirds of the equation and we'll do nothing. And people have to remember, over half of the rest of government spending is for our national defense. That's not going to go away. We have to do something. And the American people are ahead, and what I've suggested to party leaders, just be quiet. Let us have a rational conversation. Let us all hold hands and let us come to an agreement. We did that as a nation in the 1990s, and we balanced the budget.
So we
have
done
that in Social Security changes before to make sure we have preserved it. We have done it before. This is not an impossible task.
So you think there's a possibility of singing hands? Probably can't get them to sing Kumbaya, but probably could get them to hold hands.
The singing would be off note if I participated in that, but I've had these conversations, and many of my colleagues on both sides, just I'm convinced the majority is there if we could get rid of some of these artificial constraints. The sooner we do it, and this fall is the time to act, because whether people like it or not, you will begin to have the pressure of the electoral process come 2018.
I'm going to ask you something more on a personal side of this, because I've seen you talk to people and town groups, and you really present so well. 32 years ago, was it this easy, or did you screw up a lot?
Oh, I have made a lot of mistakes in my life. I told people the day I announced the concept of the Marquette Plan to recapture up to 75% of the lakeshore, which I still adhere to. We're making progress.
Huge.
The quality of place. I stand by it. You could have heard a pin drop in that room of public officials in the Rayburn Building in Washington, D.C. And before I finished my speech, I thought to myself, I made a big mistake.
What was the mistake, you think?
I made a whole series of mistakes. One, I did not sit down with each mayor of each of the communities involved to explain what I thought we should be thinking about. And again, this is voluntary, it's long term, it's as parcels come open.
You dropped the bomb.
I just told them what we're going to do. So they were not appreciative. I don't own any property on Lake Michigan in 1985 in June. I don't have USX, Arcelor, other mills that were there. Nobody called us. I would just say there's two parts of a long list of, boy, I didn't think that out.
So you've learned since then to think these things through a little bit better.
Every day, and let's make sure we communicate. And I think after 30 years of trying with the South Shore, and a lot of this has been needlessly delayed by just really unfounded arguments against it.
I've admired how you...
Is that this last go-around, the last 3-4 years, has been absolutely public, transparent, not just myself, others, yourself, everyone, made presentations, public meetings, input, people happy, sad, come up with good ideas as to, well, maybe this is a little better way to approach it. Learn from mistakes over that period of time. So I'd like to sit here and blame somebody. That never gets you any place. I can look back and say, yeah, there's a couple of approaches I took over these 30 years that probably were counterproductive myself.
Well, I've admired the way you've handled this, the South Shore expansion and so forth, because you have showed a lot of patience, a lot of accepting of difference of opinion, and it seems like it's paid off. It's been slower probably than you'd hoped, but we seem to be getting there. Why can't other people see that this approach works, or why can't they have this kind of patience?
I can't answer all of those questions, except I would say for the future of Northwest Indiana, a couple of things have also changed along the way. It's not just the argument or a light finally going off. I think that's part of it, just a repetition and openness. Part of it is the people involved. You look at the people who are managing and running the South Shore. You look at Bill Hanna and others, the board who are on the RDA. If the RDA did not exist, if it was not created by Ms. Daniels and our legislative delegation that unanimously supported it in 2005, we wouldn't be having this conversation today. So a lot of it, too, is now there's people they know where the future lies. They know what the right thing to do is. They've worked hard. They've been abused, and they've stayed the course. They understand that the caravan passes the jackal's bar.
I would agree. We've got some pretty good leaders in place
Great leaders now,
and so now's a good time to move. Is there something else you feel like we should be moving on in this region that maybe we're not making as much progress as we should? What would be that next thing? I mean, we kind of got the rail thing going. We got a number of good things going, and the Marquette plan is very far advanced, still a ways to go. Is there something else, or what's that next big project? I know we haven't got these other two done, but...
Yeah, I would say a couple of things. One, to encourage more rapid progress, that we're just not ever going to be satisfied again waiting for the steel jobs to come back. I don't ride the train. This is the way we've always done it. No, we are going to make an investment. We are going to make a change.
We Secondly, do move slowly.
Find that issue area that you do have an affinity for, you do have an expertise, and get involved. We're not done with the train, and I tell people somewhat facetiously, when we lay the first tie for the expansion, I can't wait for that person to come up and say, well, why didn't you take that to Velpo? Why didn't you take it to Lowell? Let's go do that. And on the Lakeshore, we've made some progress, but not nearly enough. Where's the pressure? Let's get going to open it up like they have in Chicago for that quality of place, so those young people that have left stop doing that and they come home. We have wetlands. I'm old enough to call them swamps in the old days. We have bike trails. Now let us connect the Calumet Wetland Preserve for that quality of place. In the past month, I've had conversations with people at Ivy Tech. I would tell you again, it's the people, it's the systems that are in place. vastly different than a generation ago. You lost your job at USX in 1985. Here's how to write a resume. Good luck getting a job. Now, as you come in, if you need some remedial help, we won't charge you for that. We will help you with that. What's your skill? Where do you want to go? Employers like NIPSCO, Porter Memorial, NITGO, we'll give you the equipment we need people trained on. We'll give you that curriculum. Then you can build an associate degree off of that. They're working on it because we can do the South Shore perfectly. How do we can draw those jobs, but then we need people with the talent to get those jobs.
How do we get people to move a little faster on some of these issues? I agree with you on, and you've, again, laid out a great agenda for what we need to do. But how do we get people to move a little faster? Because that is one of our downfalls or barriers.
I think a couple of things, Keith. One, if you don't like what we're doing, and a lot of people don't. I mean, it's just my dad told me today I got sworn in. He said, you're never going to be universally loved again. And he was right, because you got to make a decision. If you don't like what we're doing and you got a better idea, what is it? Just
don't
say
criticize.
No. What is your better idea? If you got one, listen, there are people, myself included, we are happy to get going down that road. Secondly, I do think the psychology has changed. And some of this is, yeah, they were waiting for the steel jobs to come back. This is the way it always was. That generation, by and large, has moved, or they're gone, or they're retired. And so I think as younger people are here, we aren't going to take this anymore. We are going to want more change. I think as you see people recognize the value of Northwest Indiana, absent bad weather in the winter, we have every advantage on the planet Earth. That's why we're all here. That's why Rockefeller and Morgan invested money here.
And people are appreciating it now.
And they're appreciating it. They're appreciating it now. Is young people are going to say, you know, we're starting to get these jobs, and they're manufacturing jobs. We're making things. It's not steel. It's other stuff. It could be pharmaceuticals. It could be technology. Hey, we want it different. We're going to be more active. So I think we are past the trough. And I date it to 2015, when our state legislators, and God bless them, coming together to work with Governor Pence, to finally say the state recognizes we are going to be the engine for the state. We are a Great Lakes state. We're going to invest in you. Mayor Freeman Wilson finished the runway at the airport after all these years. We're coming out of that. And I think it feeds on itself, and it's a bad analogy. I don't want to be the last one on the train. So I think it's going to change, but people ought to say, if you have a better idea, let us know. If not, get on board. Do something. The National Guard, with the encouragement of Senator Young, cooperation and leadership of Mayor Freeman Wilson, within the last month, 45 days, tore down 13 homes abandoned in the city of Gary. What's 13 homes? I got six out. It's 13 we don't have to tear down anymore. Somebody made a decision. Somebody invested money. Somebody improved 13 properties.
You know, one of the things I've always admired about you, Pete, is that you're able to just kind of lay out the issues in a very clear way. You always seem to have kind of a positive spin on where we should go, not in a false way. Right. And I've always noticed you're such a good listener when you're out at these town hall meetings and people come. Where did you kind of develop those abilities? Have you always kind of had those abilities from the start? Or is that something you've developed as time went on?
I think we all learn from our experiences, but I also think all of us have different skill sets, and maybe I just stumbled into this, but you cannot engage in public life, public service, and representative government if you don't know what you're representing. It is important to listen. And I would give you two examples. There were meetings, and they were fierce meetings. People were furious, inflamed with me over the dredging of the Indiana Harbor Ship Canal. There was no way I was ever going to change their mind. But one of the things that came out of all those meetings, because I did listen. Well, as you dredge and you put these spoils in a confined disposal area, they're going to dry out and it's going to pollute the air and poison us. I said, you know what? You may be right. So what we're going to do is right now, so we have a baseline for years before, because the air, unfortunately, isn't perfect in Ishgah, we're going to put air monitoring systems. It was a good idea. And the other thing I told people, Keith, I have to listen for the people I never hear from, because I represent 730,000 people, most of whom never communicate to me. I hear from many, many thousands of my constituents who are on Medicare. I couldn't tell you the last time somebody on Medicaid came into my office and gave me a piece of their mind, because they're just trying to get through today.
Well, I truly appreciate everything that you've done for this region and the vision you've had. If there was one more thing that you feel like, I just really got to get this done, and we're down to just probably a few seconds, I want to get this done.
Finish the train and let us open up that lakeshore for that quality of place. Let us open up that lakeshore so everyone can enjoy that immense natural resource, so we keep and attract good quality people to Northwest Indiana.
Well, you got the right ideas, and that's vision. I'm glad you made that mistake in Washington, because it's kind of led us into a good
I
place.
Learned.
So, we all need to do that, and I hope that we can learn a little bit more in the end. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank
and
you
sharing
very much.
Your thoughts. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Lakeshore Focus airs on Fridays at 7:30 p.m., and it's rebroadcast on Sundays at 9:30 a.m. on Lakeshore PBS. Hoosiers could pay more for childcare than they would with their kids' college tuition. That's from a new study, a report that was put out by a national child care policy nonprofit. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jeannie Lindsay says that the study shows that child care in Indiana costs more than 1 year at a publicly supported college.
Child Care Aware reports the average Hoosier family spends nearly a third of its income on child care costs. And for a single parent, a licensed child care program can eat up over half of their income. Early Learning Indiana's Emily Rouge says comparing the cost to college tuition highlights the huge financial impact on families.
A child is born and suddenly you need infant care, and you don't have 18 years or 16 years or that child's life in order to save for it.
Rouge says that creates problems for parents looking for child care within their budget. She says that can lead to families choosing unlicensed providers and putting children at risk despite good intentions. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
New study from Indiana University finds regular spikes in an area's birth rate can be attributed to cultural practices. For example, there's a birth spike in the United States every September and October, about 9 months after Christmas. IU researchers worked with an institute in Portugal to look at the online searches and the social media to be able to better understand people's moods and behaviors. They also looked at the data in Israel and found different birth peaks there 9 months after major Jewish and Muslim holiday celebrations. Luis Rocha led this study, and he is a professor at the Indiana University School of Informatics.
The mood that is present in these holidays is one of people are happy, are generally happy. There's less anxiety, so they tend to be calm as a whole.
Rocha says that the research, by the way, can be useful to public health officials.
This is useful, you know, to target safe sex campaigns. For instance, you wouldn't think to do it around Christmas time, but maybe that is a good time to do them. And also expanding on these techniques towards other health problems.
That is Luis Rocha, who is a professor at the IU School of Informatics. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. Tomorrow, Thursday, we don't have a Reporters Roundtable, but we will have for you a rebroadcast of the League of Women Voters program that we recently had on the air on Women in Politics. We hope you'll join us for that.